This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Well, thank you so much, Parker. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and welcome to our Season 6 premiere of Time Signatures. We are well more than 100 episodes into this journey, and I cannot tell you how excited I am to welcome our guest for this kickoff episode. Chances are, at some point along the way, you've seen this man's work because he is known as one of the most prolific rock photographers in the business. For more than half a century now, his iconic work has been part of Guitar Center's Hollywood Rock Walk. He is a feature contributor on the Led Zeppelin book, The Photographers. He is an author of several books himself and the subject of the film documentary Rock Prophecies. He has photographed the likes of Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Steve Vai, and Carlos Santana, just to name a few. But our guest was the sole photographer on hand at the August 26, 1990 show at the Alpine Music Theater for what would be the last concert of Stevie Ray Vaughan. As a fellow photographer, I cannot tell you how much this interview means to me on many levels, but Robert Knight, I would like to welcome you to Time Signatures, sir, and thank you once again for taking time to be here.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show. I look forward to the interview.
Thank you so much, sir. Robert, we have to start somewhere, so we're going to go back to the beginning, because clearly your passion for music has driven you all of these years. So I guess we'll start there. What are your earliest memories of music, sir?
Well, I grew up in Hawaii, and my father was a minister, and so I was forbidden to listen to rock music. I was forbidden to go to films. It was like a pretty restrictive environment, but I had a little transistor radio, one of those things. It actually was a quartz radio that you didn't even need a battery, and I plugged it in, and I heard a local radio station, and the first rock song or blues song I ever heard was John Lee Hooker, "It Serves You Right to Suffer." And wow. I completely freaked out. And I thought, whatever that is, I love it. And obviously it was the forbidden fruit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, definitely.
Then when I got, you know, around 14, I became aware, through television and stuff, I was a little bit more liberated. And then I was walking through Waikiki one day and I found some magazines that some British tourists had left. And they were music magazines, and they had all these guys with long hair and disheveled clothing and guitars. And I had no idea. I was like, what is that? Because at the time, the music was like Peter, Paul, and Mary, and sure, the Modern Folk Quartet, and, you know, early Bob Dylan and the Supremes. I mean, it was, you know, Dick Dale and the Deltones, the Ventures. I mean, it was pretty different. And so I obviously deduced that these were rock bands, and inside these publications, there was a place in Heener, England, where you could send away and buy albums, the Heener Record Center. So I sent away and I bought all these albums, a lot of which hadn't come out in the US yet. So I had early Who, early Yardbirds, early Jimi Hendrix. And at my high school, during the noon hour, they would play music over the intercom during the lunch hour. And I went to the school principal. I said, you know, would it be all right if I played some of my music? I had kind of become a DJ suddenly, you know? He said, sure. So I was playing the Yardbirds. I was playing all this stuff. And all these guys came up to me who were obviously musicians in a band. And they were like, what is this? Who is this? You know, I became very popular. And then the Rolling Stones were coming to Hawaii. And I think I was like 15 or something. And I snuck out. And I went to the concert, and there were like 9,000 girls, guys screaming, flashbulbs going off. I had never experienced anything like that. And Brian Jones was in the band at the time. And and I thought, well, whatever that is, I have to be part of it. And I didn't play guitar, and I didn't have an identity, but I knew I had to somehow get to England. So I actually got a job as a travel agent at 15 because I was pretty adept at understanding those OAG guides and things. And after working a year, you got one free first class ticket anywhere in the world. And I went to London at 16 by myself.
Oh my goodness.
And it was like, it was happening. You know what I mean? It was totally happening. But the synchronicity, which is an important part of my life, was that I rented a room from some people in Putney, and they looked after a photographer's studio. They were like, you know, cleaned it up and whatever they did. And they said, oh, you know, they're shooting a movie down at this guy's studio. I said, what movie? They said, oh, it's called Blow Up. And it's got this band, you know, the Yardbirds in it. And I thought, oh my God, I mean, this is it for me. Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page. I'm like, I got to know about that. And then, you know, I bought a lot of records in England and I was there and I got exposed to the club scenes and everything. And I knew that I had to, like, the idea of being a photographer suddenly pumped in my head, because the album covers, I would buy album covers, I mean, albums just based on the photo. I don't even know what the music was. I'd buy it, like, you know, Frank Zappa's Hot Rats and you know, some of these bands. I would just buy it because the visuals were so strong, particularly the Rolling Stones. So I went back to Hawaii and I caddied for about 6-9 months and made enough money to buy all my Nikon cameras and lenses.
Oh my goodness.
And my parents were worried that I was going to be drafted because the Vietnam War was going on. So I had been reading that Bill Graham in the summer of 68 had all the bands I ever wanted to work with come through San Francisco. So I did a little homework and discovered that there was a photography school in San Francisco called the San Francisco Art Institute. And I knew the editor of Rolling Stone, Jan Weiner, because he had a Hawaii connection. Mom was lived in Hawaii. So I figured, okay, this is what I'll do. So I went to the school. My classmate was Annie Leibovitz. I mean, you know, that is just really wild. So anyway, I ended up, my first concert I ever photographed was Jeff Beck with Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood on their debut. And I did a bunch of pictures and then came back the next day and I showed him to Jeff, and like, he encouraged me to shoot more. And then he came back through again a couple of weeks later and he did more shows in San Francisco. And he said, hey, there's this band. You need to look after, there's a band coming with Jimmy Page and you need to know about that band. And I said, well, what are they called? And he says, I think they're called the New Yardbirds. So I discovered that they were going to play January 2nd, 1969 at the Whiskey A Go-Go. So I convinced Jan Weiner to send me there shooting for Rolling Stone.
Wow.
So I got down there and they had changed their name because they couldn't use the word Yardbirds anymore. And it was called Led Zeppelin, and nobody knew what that meant. And they weren't the opening act, you know? And so I went to the Whiskey probably about midday. And I said, I'm with Rolling Stone magazine. I'm here to shoot the band tonight. You know, how do I do that? And she said, how old are you? And I wasn't old enough to get in. And she says, you can't get in. You got to be 21. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, this is important for the band, da, 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 da. And so she rang the Chateau Marmont and got Jimmy Page on the phone. And he told me to come over to the hotel. So I spent the whole day with Led Zeppelin up the Chateau Marmont, met everybody. And then Richard Cole, their tour manager, had me come in as road crew. And I think I carried some cymbals or something to get in the venue through the back door. And I said to Jimmy, who's headlining? He said, oh, it's some girl band. So anyway, I shot that show, which was utterly amazing, only photographer there. And then I think a couple of days later, we went up to San Francisco where I was living, and then I shot him at the Fillmore. And then Jimmy and I were sitting in the hotel, and I said, you know, you really should play Hawaii. And I called my friend who was the promoter over there, and I managed to get him to book two shows. Sight unseen, he'd never heard of this band, but I said, look, believe me, you know, they're gonna blow up fast. So he booked two shows. So that was sort of my start. And then in October of 68, Jimi Hendrix was playing the Winterland. And I got in there and I didn't have a backstage pass or anything. I had a camera. Everybody got out of my way. I walked to the front of the stage and I was just utterly shocked. I'd never experienced anything like Jimi Hendrix. And so that sort of started me. And then in that first 6 months, I worked with everybody, you know, Santana, 10 Years After, Jethro Tull. I mean, it was like all the bands, the British bands. So the first 6 months of my career, it was like a peak almost, you know? But I became friends with Led Zeppelin. And then whenever they come through Hawaii or wherever I wanted to do a show, I'd call Peter Grant. He'd give me passes. And, you know, I did up to 1975, I did a lot of Led Zeppelin photos. But I continued to work with Jeff. So fantastic. Sorry about the long-winded answer, but there's your
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
I've got some more questions about your work in San Francisco, coming up here about the Fillmore. But in the documentary Rock Prophecies, I love the simplicity of how you describe the work that you do as a professional photographer. You stated, "What do? I get paid to see." But there's really a little bit more to it than that. I think you would have to agree. I think some timing, some good fortune mixed in there as well. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. And the thing is, there weren't paparazzis per se then, but I was very cognizant that these people weren't necessarily comfortable if you had a camera in your hand all the time. So there was a big house that everybody rented at the foot of Diamond Head, and all the rock bands would stay there. So I remember going down and hanging out with Jimi Hendrix and the band, and you know, he'd be in a Speedo by the pool. And I mean, it just didn't seem appropriate without the guitar or, you know, his outfit on to be photographing him. But we spent a lot of time talking, and what I did is I made myself interesting. And you know, we can segue back to Stevie Ray Vaughan at some point, but through this entire experience in my career, I never did a single drug and I never did anything. I stayed fully clean. And all these guys were like, you know, we're like, you know, why aren't you doing this and this? And I'm just like, oh, you know, I'm into some other things. And I made myself interesting to the point of where they enjoyed hanging out and I didn't have to party. You know, I mean, it was some pretty interesting conversations, particularly with early days with Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck. You know, they were into some pretty unusual things, you know?
Yeah. Now, of course, as you talked about, you were among the first American photographers to be able to shoot with Jimi Hendrix professionally. You share this honor with a Michigan native, one of my good friends, Wilson Lindsay, who first captured Hendrix in Ann Arbor in the summer of 67, which was just shortly after his appearance at the Monterey Pop Festival in June of that year. When did you have occasion to shoot with him at first, and what was it in the United States? Was it over in England? And what was his?
Well, when I first worked with him was in October of 1968.
Okay,
and it's very interesting because you know back in the day there was no manual of how to be a rock photographer, and we were just coming off Speed Graphics and you know 4x5 cameras and things, and a lot of those guys that did that photography thought people that shot 36 exposures were like some kind of machine gun, you know, that like this was not a cool thing. They were really down on, you know, particularly motor drive. They were really upset with that whole possibility. And so I brought one roll of film to the Jimi Hendrix concert and only shot half of it. Man. And then years later, all of those photos were used on an album that came out, Jimmy Live at Winterland, all my photos from that shooter, the cover and everything live at the Winterland. So it was very interesting, you know, so I ended up becoming very good friends with Jimmy's sister.
Okay. Now I've heard that he could be quite moody at times. Did you see any evidence of that when you were working with him?
What I found was shyness and, you know, he was upset because he was broke. He didn't really understand where all his money was going through this manager that he had. And there was tremendous pressure on him by the Black Panthers to get rid of the white guys in the band. And he wasn't political. He was, you know, even though he was from Seattle, he didn't jump on that bandwagon. And there was huge pressure on him to, you know, to be more involved with that movement at the time. And he didn't, you know? And so, but I found him shy, actually. A lot of the guys that I do know were offstage were incredibly shy people, quite introverted, really. Jeff Beck, Elton John, they were very moody, but the moodiness never extended to my friendships with them. But I you know, usually I'd hear about it, but I never witnessed it, you know, that craziness.
Yeah. Now, being a young man yourself, I'd assume that the news of Jimmy's passing just a couple short years after you first met him must have had a strong impact on you.
Yeah, it did. It did because, and then I knew people that were with him the night he died. Oh, and, you know, my friend Judy Wong was there. Eric Burdon was there. They all had dinner with him. He was happy. He was up. There was nothing that would indicate, he was in, you know, any kind of depression. And there's a lot of mystery because, you know, Jeff Beck told me that there were a lot of rumors that he'd been murdered, you know, and there was a lot of that swirling around. And that had come and go over the years. But his manager was some sort of spy. I think he was with MI5, one of those sort of things. And he ended up on a plane that blew up from a bomb. And wow. All the money that Hendrix made was going into the Caribbean to some company. And so when Jimi Hendrix got control over the estate again, they were trying to figure out, you know, what on earth this whole legal morass was, you know, with Jimmy's money. But he basically was broke when he died. He didn't have a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
You know.
And that seems like that was a pretty well multiplied story with music back then. People
over and
took
over.
Advantage
I can't
of
tell you the number of artists that, like Peter Frampton, lost so much money from his manager. Yeah. And you know, the guys that had been taken advantage of, they just didn't know, you know. And I don't think anybody back in the day knew how to read a contract.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they don't know the difference between net and gross. <You know? laughs> So, yeah. But I, you know, I didn't do work for hire for a very long time. I wanted to own everything. I, for somehow, had a premonition that I needed to keep ownership, and I just would only license or sell prints, but I never would, like, I would not sell my buyout, you know,
sure,
which
sure.
was probably intuitive at the time.
Robert, in an interview that I came upon recently, you talked about being at the Fillmore in 1968 for many of the shows that were held there, which led me to think, were you also in the area in August of 69 when Peter Green and Fleetwood Mac came through?
Probably, but I can't, I, you know, I saw so many, but actually the first time I went to the Fillmore was 67. I flew over from Hawaii to see Cream do a debut, and I wasn't a photographer yet, so it might have been even a little bit earlier. I can't remember. I'd have to look up when Cream played the Fillmore, but I had had their album before it had come out in the US.
Okay.
And so I got there on a red eye, so I got into San Francisco probably 6 or 7 in the morning, and I just sat outside the Fillmore. And Bill Graham came up and he saw me out there and he's like, "What are you doing out here?" And I'm just like, "Oh, I flew in from Hawaii all night. And, you know, I just want to see this band." He says, "Well, come on inside." I watched the sound check, you know?
Oh, wow.
And so then when Cream came on stage, Eric sort of announced to the audience, "So what do you guys want to hear?" And I yelled out, "Toad." He looked at me and he said, "Thanks a lot." Which is like, 15-minute drum solo, you know. So that was pretty funny. But that, I was able to see Cream, but I probably saw, you know, I definitely saw a lot of Sly and the Family Stone, which was just amazing because, you know, Jeff Beck actually opened for them a bunch, and he was, you know, blown away by Sly, who ended up marrying a girl from Hawaii. So, I mean, there was always that connection. And being in Hawaii was great because whenever anybody would come to Hawaii, the local promoter would call me and say, "Hey, the record company's got $5,000. Would you look after this guy for a week or 2 weeks?" You know, I had Alice Cooper as a guest. Took him out to play tennis and go fishing. I just would call my friends, "Hey, you want to play golf?" And then Alice Cooper would turn up. And then he said to me years later, when my movie came out, he said, "Do you remember when you shot Whiskey at the Led Zeppelin at the Whiskey? Did you do that?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you remember who they were opening for?" I said, "I don't know, Jimmy, we had to leave." And Jimmy said, "It was a girl band." He said, "It was me."
Oh, wow.
So it was Alice Cooper. But I think when Jimmy Page saw that, he just, like, it didn't, you know, I don't think anybody knew exactly who Alice Cooper was at that point in time.
Yeah.
On a very large scale.
It certainly makes sense.
But now, Alice gave me a bad time about that.
Well, Robert, when you and I first spoke, not even a week ago here, you referred to that documentary and you stated that it contained a little bit about Stevie Ray and a lot about my dear friend, Jeff Beck. It made me realize that you were not just doing photography. You actually established relationships with these people, didn't you?
I did. And particularly with Jeff, because I was, you know, I had worked with Jeff a lot. And then around 84, he came to LA and always stayed at the Sunset Marquee. And he was shooting the People Get Ready video, and I was shooting on that. And so we spent a lot of time driving around in his 32 Ford hot rod. And Jeff would leave the car with me. So I had it in my garage in Los Angeles. And then anytime he'd come to LA, he'd call me and I'd pick him up at the airport and he'd jump in the car. And then we would drive, you know, to my house. He'd let me out and then he'd go check in at the Sunset Marquee. And then when he was ready to leave, we reversed the process. So then I'd go get him, drive him back to the airport. And then, so that started to open that relationship. And then he would invite me over to England to stay with him. And then he'd always go, oh yeah, while you're here, can you bring some car parts? So I was constantly moving car parts from LA, and you know, and he lived much closer to Gatwick Airport than Heathrow. So when I would come in and the customs people would look at what I had and they go, what's all this then? And I said, oh, car parts for Jeff Beck. And they go, oh, we know Jeff, carry on. You know? They were quite familiar with flywheels and whatnot coming through.
Wow.
But yeah, I spent a lot of time at his house. And then I met a lot of people through Jeff. Extraordinary. Because he invited me for Christmas in 85. And he said, you know, tell me an imaginary group of people you think would be cool to be at a party. Who would you want to meet there? And I gave him a list of people. And when I got there, he threw a party and all those people were there.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, so I was with Jeff Beck with a big vegetarian Indian buffet. And I'm in the room with Clapton and Keith Richards and Dave Gilmore and Ringo. And I mean, it was just like bananas, you know what I mean? So I remember spending most of the evening talking with Dave Gilmore and Eric Clapton about fishing. Because they're both avid fishermen. No talking about music.
Yeah.
So, but then, you know, as I got close with Jeff, he called me around 88. He says, I have a problem. I got a new band, but my drummer looks like a combine machine. And I went, what's it? He said, no, he's got wire going to his nose and his stomach and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, who is it? He said, Terry Bozzio. And I had met Terry Bozzio when he was like 16. I met him when he was with Frank Zappa and I knew him. So I then reconnected with Bozzio and I did a lot of pictures of that. And then I went to England and I shot the band. I shot Tony Jaimes. And then Jeff called me in 1989. He said, can you come back to Minneapolis because we're rehearsing at Paisley Park and, you know, why don't you come out on the tour? And that's where I met Stevie Ray for the first time. And they were at Princess Paisley Park. So, you know, that was pretty wild. And then Stevie, we went to dinner one night and Stevie said, I feel like I met you. And it turned out I had met Stevie Ray Vaughan when he was a teenager in Dallas, Texas. He was auditioning for a Hawaiian band called the Laughing Kahunas as their new guitar player. Guys I knew from Hawaii. And the guy that was managing that band was a sort of gangster. A sort of a mafia figure in Dallas. And so Stevie went home and told his dad he was joining this band. He said his daddy took off his belt and was going to whip him because he said, I ain't having no son of mine working for that gangster.
Wow.
But I had actually met Stevie Ray when he was a teenager.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Returning to Jeff for a minute. Sadly, yeah. We lost him in January of 2023.
Yeah, that was a huge blow for me. It still bothers me.
What is your fondest memory of Jeff, Robert?
Well, I have so many, but there was a photo shoot that I did in LA. The manager called me and said, you know, we're going to send Jeff over for 3 or 4 days. Can you just shoot with him and see what you could come up with? So we went everywhere together, you know, the desert and up in the Malibu Mountains and everything. And he was so happy with the shoot. He said, can I come over to your house and make dinner for you? And I said, sure. So I was living in Palisades at the time and we went across the street and Jeff was pushing a grocery cart, buying all this food. We ran into Peter Graves from Mission Impossible and he made this dinner. And then I remembered back one day that these kids that I grew up in Hawaii that teased me because I wasn't a guitar player. I said, you know, one day Jeff Beck will be my friend and he's going to sing happy birthday to me on my birthday. And that turned out to be true. It happened at the Sunset Marquee, and he threw a birthday party for me. I bought me 2 bottles of Verve Clico.
How cool.
Yeah, so those are the kind of memories I had, you know. And then he called me a lot for advice because he had all these decisions to make, and he didn't like any of them. And he would ask me, you know, what should I do? You know, he was on tour with Rod Stewart, wasn't happy opening after about four shows. Mick Jagger called him and said, you know, I'm doing an album in the Caribbean. You want to play on it? And then he called me. He says, you know, what should I do? I said, well, if you don't like this thing with Rod, and he literally didn't show up for the next show and went to the Caribbean.
Man.
And worked on the first, you know, Mick Jagger solo album, you know.
One of the coolest items that I have in my collection, and you can see it up over my head in the corner here, is that orange 45 that's actually signed by Jeff. And it is a prized piece of my collection. But I want to flip the page here. Something else that I found interesting about you. Go ahead.
No, just go ahead. You should.
Okay. Yeah. Something else that I found interesting about you in that video that you shared was your passion for seeking out new talent and photographing them earlier in their careers. Now, was it more about posterity that fed that need? Or was it about capturing them in their innocence, maybe before the craziness of fame took hold?
Well, what happened is this movie was really not something that I tried to have happen, because a friend of mine who is in the music instrument business was trying to do a television series, a reality show with Ronnie Wood. Mm-hmm. And the producer of that supposed new documentary on Ronnie Wood was the same guy that did Will and Grace and Seinfeld. So he had a meeting with that guy, and he said, well, do you know Ronnie Wood? And he said, no. He said, have you ever met Ronnie Wood? And he said, no, but I have a friend that does. He said, well, tell your friend to come out here. So I went out to LA to meet with this guy that was the producer of Will and Grace and Seinfeld. And he said, so do you think we could get Ronnie Wood to do this reality show? And I said, no, you won't get him. And he said, why? And I said, well, first of all, you can't use the Rolling Stones name, likeness, or music, because that's not going to happen. And I said, plus, he's struggling with some issues, and they need to get tour insurance, and Mick doesn't want to have all that on camera. And I don't think that that's a really good idea, the life of Ronnie Wood at that part of his life. So I said, I don't think that would happen. And my friend was really upset, because I pretty much squashed his TV idea, you know? But then he said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a photographer. And he said, well, who have you worked with? And I said, well, who haven't I worked with, you know? And he said, well, let's do a reality show on you. And I went, no, I don't want that. My wife will flip out. You know, we have cameras in the house and everything. It doesn't work out. So anyways, and then he said, well, let's go have sushi. And I said, no, I'm going to get back in the car and drive back to Las Vegas. And so while I was driving back to Las Vegas, he called me. He says, well, what would you do? I said, you know, I might do a documentary where I'd give back to the artists that helped me through my life and give them some coverage or something. And he said, well, who could you get? And I said, well, who do you want? He said, well, who's the hardest person to get? I said, Jeff Beck. He just never does anything like that. Can you get him? I said, hold on. Pulled off the side of the road. I rang Jeff and I said, Jeff, they're doing a documentary on my life. And he said, can I be in it? So we had Jeff Beck. So then it made everything else easier to get. So then I called Santana, and then he said, well, who else do you have? I said, Jeff Beck. He said, okay, I'm in. And then I called Billy Gibbons. Who else do you have? Oh, Jeff Beck. And said, I'm in. You know, and so it just went down. You know, we got everybody, you know. And
that's cool.
And so then he brought in a director who was a young guy named John Chester. And John had never done anything in the music industry. I don't think he knew the difference between Keith Moon and Keith Richards, you know? And I was sort of like, well, this is really weird. And he said, well, this guy thinks you're full of BS, because, you know, a lot of people in Hollywood say they know people and they don't. And he said, he wants to have lunch with you to make sure you're not full of it. I said, okay. So I arranged for a table at the Sunset Marquee for three people. And then he and I were having lunch, and I had called a friend and I said, can you come at lunch? He said, sure. And so my friend is sort of talking to me, the director anyway, and he's saying, well, do you actually know these people? And as he asked that, Slash walks in full regalia and sits down with us. So
solve that problem.
Solve that problem. So that's how we got Slash. The director was like, well, Robert, you know, you knew to go after Jeff Beck and Led Zeppelin and all these bands before anybody else. You were chasing these guys. Can you still do that? So I said, oh, probably. And he said, well, find some bands that we could film for the documentary that by the time the movie comes out, maybe they'll break. So the first person I found was Tyler Bryant, who was like 15 or 16 years old.
Yeah.
He had won the Robert Johnson Award, Best Blues Player and all of that. So
yes, sir.
I had Tyler Bryant. And then I got the Sick Puppies out of Australia, who was a band about to break up. A band out of the Ireland called The Answer, Panic at the Disco, got them really early days. And so we filmed them, and we're kind of jumping all over the place. But when the film came out, we won three film festivals. We were in high rotation on Amazon, on Apple, and PBS. And I started getting emails from young guys, mostly, saying, can you help me like you helped Tyler Bryant? So I went to Guitar Center and I talked to them and I talked to people over at Fender. And I said, we ought to put together a program where I find these young guys and girls and support them and help them and give them musical instruments and, put ads together and put their photo on the outside of the Guitar Center. And they agreed. So I established this thing called the Brotherhood of the Guitar. And
that was all you.
And that was me. And so I put that together. And right now I have over 150 young guitar players and about 40 drummers, because all these guitar players that are 14, 15, 16 didn't know any drummers their own age. And so I figured, and I'll do a support system for that. So a lot of the guys that I had on my program have now gone on to be in rather big bands and are touring the world right now, or they're very successful producers. Like Tyler Bryant just won his second Grammy as a producer.
Mm.
And so I still have that. It's an ongoing program. And, and I'm supported now by Ernie Ball Guitars, Taylor Guitars, and Guitar Center, and Dunlap Pedals. So they enable me to shine the light. So it's a constant process. And then I'm able to get these kids incredible discounts if they're part of the Brotherhood. So that saves a lot of money for them. And it's just worked out. So I'm really happy about that.
You know, Robert, this really shines a light on your moral base, because quite honestly, it's refreshing to see that you're working so diligently with these younger people. It reminds me quite a bit of the blues in the school type of a function, on a different level, of course. But it's really cool because it gives you an opportunity to see them prosper and take advantage of the opportunities.
Right.
But you didn't have to do that, did you?
I just felt it actually made me, one, feeling younger. You know what I mean? It was like that excitement that I had when I discovered Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page.
Sure.
That wonder was missing, because we were going into electronica and there was a lot of, just like weird music that wasn't guitar centric. And I felt like the guitar was going to die if someone didn't do something about it, And so I think in a way, it really got involved. And then, I've been with the Guitar Center since 1985, and my wife and I both, we had at one point 3,000 10-foot photos on the outsides of the Guitar Center. And it gave me an opportunity again to put up people that no one knew. So I had Tyler Bryant up when he was 16. I had Orianthe up. She was probably 17. I had Panic at the Disco up when no one knew who they were. There was just a lot of young artists that I would mix in with Slash and Billy Gibbons and, Jeff Beck or whoever, Tony Iommi, whatever it happened to be. And then being a director of the Rock Walk, I was able to bring in Rock Walk inductions of all my heroes. And I particularly emphasized the blues to get these guys in there, because that was my favorite, right? So I got Buddy Guy on there, and I got Ike Turner, which was controversial at the time to try to do that. Solomon Burke, the people that influenced the Rolling Stones, I was able to do that, And I became friends with a lot. I was really good, actually became good friends with John Lee Hooker. But when he saw my wife's work, he said, Robert, I love you, but the Marianne is much more beautiful and I like her work. So my wife got all of that. But B.B. King, I knew a lot. Bo Diddley. It was great, and the Guitar Center, that offered me that window to kind of almost create my own rock and roll fantasy camp to see these guys get inducted. It was cool.
Yes, sir. We got to flip the page again. August 1990, you were invited to go to East Troy, Wisconsin, and shoot what would be the final concert of Stevie Ray Vaughan. Robert, how did that gig come together for you?
Well, this is, again, a tremendous amount of synchronicity, because I had gotten a phone call from Stevie Ray, and he said, I'm going to do this important concert series, and they're going to do a poster for Fender of all of us lined up, and it's with Eric and Buddy Guy and Jimmy and, you know, a whole bunch of guys, and I want you to be the guy that shoots it. And I said, well, where are you? And he says, well, I'm in Maui. And I said, well, I'm in Honolulu at the moment. And I said, what are you doing there? And he says, I'm on hanging with my new girlfriend from New Zealand. And I said, well, I have a girlfriend from New Zealand. You know, I mean, it was like, there was that synchronicity. So I flew back. This is a very weird story. I hope you have enough time.
Yeah,
so
go ahead,
I flew
go ahead.
Back and I met him, and we, you know, everybody was there early on the 25th. He was really excited about this photo shoot. And Eric was coming in with his whole entourage on helicopters, but Stevie was there with tour bus. Anyway, Eric doesn't show up until right before the gig.
Mm.
And he forgot about the photo shoot. So he said to me, Robert, look, I'll have the press people shoot the 25th, but the 26th, you could be the only guy. So just hang with Stevie today. So Stevie and I started talking, and it got weird quickly, because Stevie said to me, you know, I'm going to die. I'm like, what? He said, no, Dr. John called me and told me that I was going to die and I needed to look out. And I said, well, he said, but I almost died once before and God gave me a second chance. And, you know, when it's your time to go, it's your time to go. And I said, well, did you know that Otis Redding died nearby here in a lake? He said, my manager was his manager. You know, it was all of this, right? So then Stevie says to me, where are you staying? I said, I'm staying right behind the venue. There's a hotel there in the winter. It's a ski resort. And he said, check out of that place. I said, why? He said, oh, I've stayed there. I have a very bad feeling about that place. You need to check out. I said, well, I'll check out in the morning, but all my stuff's over there and everything. And so he said, well, you go to Milwaukee in the morning and rent another room. Okay. So in the morning, I checked out and all my lighting equipment had disappeared. And I thought, right, that's what Stevie was talking about. There are thieves or something here. So I went to Milwaukee and I think I talked to Stevie and I said, look, I've got to look for lighting equipment too. And this was portable lighting. This wasn't my main lighting, because I had left that at the site to do the shoot on the 26th. Got a big studio lighting backdrop and all of that. Right. And so I couldn't find the lighting, and I got this other hotel in Milwaukee, and then we came, and then Eric showed up, and then we did this really big shoot, and then, you know, I did a lot of stuff with the band, a lot of stuff, you know, really crazy stuff, and then I shot the concert, and then afterward, backstage, Eric said, hey, you know, I got an empty seat in my helicopter, you want to go back, anybody want to go back to Chicago early? And Stevie said, come on, Robert, we'll go down to Buddy Guy's Club. I was like, I'm not going in a helicopter. Plus all my stuff's in Milwaukee, you know. And he went. And he went by himself, which was very weird, because he didn't go anywhere by himself. He always had someone with him. And it was all rather strange. So it got weirder, because afterward he said for me, leave the venue right now. I know a back road to get out of here so you don't have to go on the freeway. So I had this back road, and then I heard this sound. It sounded like a car wreck, and I didn't make much of it. And then I went back to the hotel in Milwaukee, and I was really pumped. I was really excited about that shoot we had done and the photos that I got. And I went back to the hotel, and my assistant and I were going to have a drink or something. And then I decided, you know what, I'm going to go to bed. And I woke up at 9 in the morning. An alarm had gone off that had been set by the previous person that had stayed in that room. And it was the news, and it said Eric Clapton had died in a helicopter crash. And I'm like, what? So I called his hotel in Chicago, the Four Seasons, and I said, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan's room, da-da-da. And Alex Hodges, his manager's son, answered. I said, what happened to Eric? He said, it wasn't Eric, it was Stevie.
Oh, Lord.
And I was like, oh, wow. And then, of course, I got inundated by magazines and publications that wanted the last photos, and I wouldn't let anybody have them. I just refused. Because it was my friend. And I just, like, they're going to put it next to a crashed helicopter. And, you know, I don't want any part of that. And I waited 2 years before I did anything with those photos. So that was it. There's a lot more weirdness, but I don't, well, anyway, Stevie died behind that hotel he told me to check out of. That's where the helicopter came down, you know.
You mentioned a conversation that you had with Stevie. That was it the day of that concert?
Yeah. But
And what
Dr.
did he
John had
say?
called him. So Dr. John called him, and Dr. John had talked to some voodoo person in New Orleans called the Reverend Mother. And she said, "You know that Stevie Ray Vaughan needs to look out. He's gonna die." So Dr. John called him. Because I had done some shows with Dr. John and Stevie Ray and Joe Cocker earlier that year. And so I knew they were friends. So Stevie told me that. And then he said he felt like his career was about to explode. And I mean, there was a lot of this sort of strange stuff. And then it got weirder. I don't know if we should really go into it, but there was a lot more psychic, synchronistic stuff that happened around that night. And
Well, you
people,
gave he's you said that he gave you a message. He told you something to look for.
yeah, I said, "If anything ever happens to me, you'll know me when you hear me," before he left. And I'm like, "Wow, what does that mean?" But when I
No
heard
kidding.
Tyler Bryant, I thought, "It's Stevie." And I heard Kenny Wayne Shepherd, and I'm like, "It's Stevie." You know what I mean? It's like all these kids became that, everybody used to emulate, Eddie Van Halen and Eruption and everything, all these up and coming kids. Now they're doing Stevie Ray Vaughan, all these young
Yeah.
guys.
Yes, they are.
So I guess I kind of got that, that legacy was passed on to a new generation of young guitar players, which John Mayer is one of, because when I met John Mayer the first time, all he wanted to talk about was Stevie Ray Vaughan. I've given him a bunch of photos, and it's like when I met Dave Grohl, all he wanted to know about was John Bonham and Led Zeppelin, asked me a million questions, but I like the fact that rock stars are also fans of other artists that, inspired them. And so the Brotherhood was really in memory of Stevie Ray Vaughan too,
Very cool. Very cool.
And
Robert,
what
in
was
the.
weird, Stevie was about to be married in a couple of weeks, and he was telling me about the New Zealand girl Jana, and he was going to marry. This was the love of his life, and when he died, more or less she was put out into the street. She didn't have anything. They just
And
told her to go away.
he had just gotten clean, just gotten himself
Got
straightened
right. He'd been
away.
clean for four or 5 years, and he'd gotten
Yeah.
to zero because he had great debt. When he was using and he was strung out, the previous manager had never paid the taxes or something. So he found himself in a horrible situation of owing all this money. So he was
Wow.
touring incessantly and paid that debt down and was at zero. And he was getting a new place with Jana, and he'd been living with his mother. He gave me a phone number for his mother to call him. And so Jana went around and became a big model in Tokyo and everything like that. But then she ended up reaching out to me, many years later, and she was going to move back to New Zealand, and I was down here, and she asked me, where should she live, et cetera, et cetera. So now she's one of my dear friends. My wife and I hang out with John all the time. So I get a lot of really cool stories about her 5 years with Stevie,
Yeah. Robert, in the decades that have followed, you've had the privilege of shooting with everybody from Kenny Wayne Shepherd to ZZ Top. I mean, basically anybody who's anybody in the music world, man. What is your one main personal takeaway that you've collected as someone that has seen and recorded so much music history after all these years?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I don't know what my life would be, even regardless if I was a photographer or not, without music. I feel like music is one of the most important things we have. I feel like music and the musicians are more important than politicians. Because if you look at what Bono did to get Nelson Mandela out of jail, it had more to do with him than it had to do with George Bush or anybody else. What
Right.
Sting has done for attention on the Amazon rainforest, there nobody'd be talking about it, but because Sting talked about it, or Elton John with AIDS, and it's like they got stuff done, and I feel like
Yes,
that
sir.
is a very powerful thing. And I feel like, these songs that I hear, they bring back unbelievable memories for me. When I hear a Led Zeppelin song, or I hear a Jeff Beck song, or Slash, because I also got very close with Slash over the years too. He's a really good dear friend of mine. And And yeah, I like Slash a lot, you know.
Well, Robert, I would assume you've got a website so people can order photographs from you. We would love to get that information out there. And go ahead and talk briefly while you're talking about that. Talk about the work you're doing with your wife, because I understand she's an equally good photographer, according
She
to
is.
Robert Hooker.
Yeah. No, her name is Marianne Billum, and she's a New Zealander. And she had shot a bunch of, she was living in Hong Kong when I met her. She represented some of my photography in Hong Kong in a library she had. And when I came through Hong Kong, I met her.
Oh,
And
wow.
then she moved to the US, and then she started shooting. And she's a much different kind of photographer. She's very into the lighting and the studios and the setup, where I'm much more of a guerrilla photographer. I love being in the pit and spontaneous. And, you know, I'm used to Elton John saying, "I need to do two changes of an outfit. Can you do this all in 15 minutes?" You know, and that's like how I didn't have a problem with that. You know, I shot like that a lot. And then when I do a rock walk induction, some of my photo shoots would last 90 seconds, but I would get it, you know, Little Richard or somebody like that. You know, you do it. Where she is more thought out, more deliberate. She's done a lot of album covers for the Go-Go's, John Five. She's done work with Zakk Wylde. And then for over a decade, worked closely with Carlos Santana. So closely that I have a guitar behind me that Carlos sent her and gave it to her and signed it. You know, I mean, that's how powerful her work. So it's Marianne Billum. And then if you go Knight Billum photo, if you put that into Google, you'll come up to our website. And then we both are very much on Instagram. I have a very active Instagram account too, at Robert M. Knight Photo. And you know, I have galleries all over the country too, you know, here and there. So,
And you told me that we have a gallery here in the state of Michigan, yeah?
yeah, there's it's in, I think, Bloomington or what is it, Birmingham? I can't remember the name of
Birmingham?
it.
Yeah, Birmingham.
Yeah,
That's what you
it's the
said.
Robert Kidd Gallery, and it's, I think, right up across the street from the Four Seasons or something.
I promise you,
Really
I will
nice.
find a link to it and I'll make sure
Yeah.
to put it into this episode so that people here in Michigan can go check out your
Yeah.
work.
And then I'll make you a
So,
prediction. I got a prediction for you. I'm
all right.
working with a young guitar player for 5 years, and this is one of the most astonishing guitar players that I have run across for a very long time. And he was going the usual route that these guys do. And I said, "Well, look, if you're going to want to do Stevie Ray or this guy, so why don't you try to emulate a guitar player that is really hard to emulate?" And he could now play any song that Jeff Beck did perfectly. He can do any song that
Wow.
Dave Gilmour could do perfectly. He could do any song by Prince. His intonation, his ability to get the sound and the tone as opposed to a billion notes is extraordinary. And when he was, there's a whole long story about how Crossroads, the festival, got created, but I put that together, the original concept, because Eric was the only guy that we didn't have in the Rock Walk. And I ran into Eric one night at a Doyle Bramhall concert, and I said, "We want to put you in the Rock Walk." And he's like, "Well, I don't want to be there unless you were raising money for my charity." So I went to the Guitar Center CEOs. I said, "Guys, we got to do this big concert with Eric. We'll raise money for his charity. We could do clinics, sell guitars, the whole thing." They said, "Great, but we don't know how to do that. If you can figure out how to do it, we'll underwrite it." So I brought in a friend of mine, and that's how the first Crossroads was done. So they've
I'll be
always
darned.
allowed me to kind of bring in one or two guitar players at each Crossroads that no one's heard of. So at the very last Crossroads, I brought my young guy from England named Isaac Holmes, and he played the opening party on the roof of the Grammy building, opening for Don Felder, and he did two Jeff Beck songs and blew everybody away. When I sent Eric the video of him first, he thought it was an AI. He didn't think the kid was real. He thought it was Jeff
Wow.
playing with some kid, the AI, you know?
Holy cats.
So in less than a year, this boy who was 17 when he played Crossroads was invited by the Royal Albert Hall to play at a sold-out show. How many 18-year-olds get to play Royal Albert Hall at 18?
Wow.
So he's got a new EP that dropped a couple days ago, but you know, he's also a great singer and songwriter, and he's evocative. You know, he can play the guitar like you can't believe. I'll send you know, an email or something with some of his links, but he also can create that evocative Dave Gilmour, you know, haunting melody, you know. It's astonishing. So that's my prediction of the next unbelievable young guitar player.
Listen, I hope you keep this up.
Yeah.
You're on your mission the way that I'm on my mission. I mean, it's one of those
Yeah.
things for me on a much, much smaller scale. Trust me. I believe what I'm doing, there's direction here. This is supposed to happen. This is the stuff I'm supposed to be doing. And I love seeing what you're doing to bring the next generation up and get exposure for them, just like you did
Yeah.
for Zeppelin and so many others.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Robert
I mean,
Knight.
That's my goal. Yeah.
Robert Knight, I can't tell you how much it means to me that you've taken time to join me today on
Well,
Time
thank you.
Signatures. It's
Yeah,
my
yeah.
hope that we will continue to see your incredible work for years to come, sir. And
Yeah.
as a fellow photographer with much less credentials than you have,
Ah.
it has been a significant pleasure to preserve some of your stories for generations to come. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, sir. All right. Very good.
All right. Well, that wraps up this edition of our season 6 premiere edition of the Time Signatures program with Jim Irvin. Once again, my thanks to Robert Knight, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.